That was the year the terrible tidal wave hit the New England coast. October 5th. I remember it well. I always offer my communion for Jenny on that day. I afterwards learned that Jenny was in the habit of sailing out every day alone to a little cove near an abandoned lighthouse.
Land's End Light.
During one of those trips, the waves struck. That was the last anyone ever saw of her.
Land's End Light. That's where I'll find her.
But Jenny is dead, Mr. Evans. You must accept that fact. Hard as
I
it
won't
may
accept
be
it. Don't tell me she's dead. I held her in my arms 3 months ago, not 10 years ago. I love her. I want her back.
What vision has been vouchsafed you, I can't say. But don't doubt the ways of Providence. You must have faith. We know so little, so very little.
I don't mean to be abrupt, and I'm grateful for your kindness. When did you say that wave struck the coast?
October 5th.
And today is?
October 1st.
That leaves me 4 days.
But, Mr. Adams, that October 5th was many years ago.
Are you so sure? You say we know so little. You say Jenny's parents were killed. I found her sobbing on a bench the night it happened. You say she was a student here. I visited her here. You say she went to New England with her aunt. I was with her just before she left. Then how can you say it all happened many years ago? Yes. We know so little. And yet now, I know a little more. I know now the pattern of Jenny's life. But I also know that I am part of it. She herself said that strands of our lives were woven together and that neither time nor the world could break them. This I have faith in. Thank you, Mother. I must hurry now.
Thank you for your kindness.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop, and with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
I am a work of art all my own. Sorry, these are getting weak. I know they are, but I try to bring it into the theme, but that was a weak one.
That's a work of art is what that is.
that was very narcissistic, but I'm going with it.
Okay, whatever works for you. And Jeff Omega is also on the line. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, man, this artist, when he's showing around his art and people are like, I really wish I could just like your art, you know? I was like, I know.
So you're the beginning of the movie and Sam's the end.
No, really not. Not at all.
Trish Coughlin is MIA because if you listen to last week's episode, her sleep schedule's all fucked up and we can't seem to wake her. So she might show up. She might not. I don't know. It's going to be a surprise today. That's what Invasion of the Isolation does. But we're going to be doing a fan challenge today, guys.
Yay. And oh boy, was it a good challenge.
Yeah, I got to thank Robert Mahler for giving us this fan challenge. We're going to be doing Portrait of Jenny from 1948. And this was a spectacular movie, I have to say. I do have to curse him a little bit because spectacular movies are really hard to remake.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is going to be really tough. This is going to be, this felt like when we did Peeping Tom, where this is a really good movie that stands on its own. That might be able to, we could update a little bit, but it's not, it's one of those movies you don't really want to touch.
I think it is a really great movie that stands fine on its own. But when he suggested it, I didn't know it existed. I didn't know what it was. I don't know about you guys.
Oh, no, I had no idea. And it's a shame that we didn't know what this was and that maybe it's not as well known as it should be because it is so wonderful.
It is. It absolutely was. Jeff, what did you think?
Hey, you know, it was interesting. Watching through the whole thing, I kind of wasn't sure what I thought about it. And then this morning, kind of thinking on it some more. I think I was on the other side of the fence. I thought it was kind of what resulted in a good movie, but it is ultimately more of like an ego project for David O. Selznick, I kind of felt.
Oh, Selznick, for sure. You can definitely see it over this project. Like, this is 1948. This movie had a budget of over $4 million for 1948. That's more than Gone with the Wind, another O. Selznick project. Gone with the Wind was over 3 hours long. This is like 89 minutes. Like, this movie went way over budget and doesn't have near the scale or scope of Gone with the Wind. That micromanaging cost him a lot of money, and this movie bombed as well. It was released under this name and another one, and it bombed both times.
Yes, it did. Tidal Wave.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. Tidal Wave. Yeah, trying to use the action sequence at the end.
Yeah, and yeah, that was a mistake there. But I mean, it's just one of those movies that I just don't know if it was not the right movie for the time, or just because he spent so much damn money. I mean, it ended his career, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. He made one more movie a decade later, and that one bombed as well. And the movie previously that he made before this one also bombed. But you look at the films that he produced during his tenure, there's some great movies in there. I mean, Gone with the Wind being top of among them. When I was watching this, I'm like, okay, yeah, this definitely feels, has that scope that I think he was shooting bigger than it needed to be.
Yeah, I think the budget was a big part of it, certainly. And he's ambitious. This is such a great story, and he clearly wanted to tell it well. But I think that, yeah, switching directors partway through had a lot to do with it.
That final scene at the end is probably where a lot of the money went. They won a special effects Oscar for this film because of that ending sequence with the lighthouse and the tidal waves coming through. They built all these tanks to crash down on this completely homemade set of this lighthouse in this island, and then they had people spraying the actors with fire hoses and then the big fans as well, and it looks great. Really believable.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was talking to you as I was sort of getting near the end there, and I'm like, special effects, really?
Yeah.
And then I saw that, I'm like, okay, I see it.
Yeah, he's like, for the canvas in front of the lens?
Which did look really cool, and it was probably fairly innovative at the time. I mean, it was a great way of sort of indicating that you were getting a transition from one scene to the next.
Yeah.
I have to say that even though it's 1948, it does look really good still.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting that we did...
really good. He died while making this movie.
Yeah, another cinematographer did come on to replace him that went uncredited. But yeah, the cinematographer had passed away in the middle of making this movie. It was a long production too, between start of shoot and final product. It was almost like 2 years, from my understanding.
Yeah, that is a long time.
Yeah, it was a big production. Originally, I mean, just think about this for a second, because we have Jenny, who first appears in the film as a young teenager. And then we have this growth of the character into adulthood. And he actually wanted to follow an actress from that age up until her adulthood to film this. So you think, okay, a couple of years, this would have been a 15-year project.
Which has worked. Boyhood worked really well. So somebody did sort of take that seat and made it work. But...
yeah, well, the problem is you can't, your main actor, who is an older actor, what was older than the character anyway, probably in his mid-30s. He would have been in his 50s by the time they finished shooting this damn thing with their scenes with each other. So,
and that's
the character you don't want to age.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. I guess that's a good tease. We should tell everybody what this movie's about. Like, this is, this is quite something. Like, it is what I guess it's a romantic fantasy, right? And it takes place during the Great Depression of 1934, and this starving artist, literally a starving artist, is doing drawings and trying to sell them for quick cash just to get his next meal or pay a little bit of his rent. So, you know, he's taking this art to an art gallery to get it appraised or just make a sale so he can survive. And in his journeys, he does meet this young teen Jenny, who's quite fascinating to him, and he does sketch her, and he does come across her over periods of time, but every time he comes across her, she's a little bit older and a little bit older, like unnaturally so. There's only maybe a few weeks pass for him, and like, we're talking years and years. The setup for that is pretty great, because their first meeting, she's like, I'll hurry up and grow up so we can be together. It's quite something. And the performances are great for teenage version of Jenny to her adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw Jenny, I didn't, like, because I didn't know what this movie was really about. I didn't read anything about it. I just watched it.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite what I expected either.
No, but that's probably the weakest point in the film is the youngest Jenny, because you could tell that she was an older actress, and it was really hard to engage with her.
Her
performance was excellent.
Yeah, I thought her performance was great. The camera was working from a more higher angle to make her look smaller. She did look young to me. And yeah. I think, to me, they did a good job with that age, given what the makeup limitations were at the time. I felt like, okay, maybe she wasn't as young as maybe she was acting and portraying in their first meeting, but for the most part, that age progression looks really good to me.
And I agree, like I said, but that was the weakest point for me, because you could tell that she wasn't an 11-12 year old girl.
Yeah, right? No, I would have, like, looking at her, even how they presented her, would have probably been going like 15-16, but they clearly, through the dialogue and stuff, she was meant to be a lot younger than that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, if that's my weakest point of the film, and that's also because I didn't understand what I was watching until a couple scenes later, where I realized that she was getting older and that it was the same actress portraying a child through time, right? Or Jenny through time. So in retrospect, it was quite good. But initially, I'm like, that's really odd casting for such a young person. But again, as I got further into the movie, it made more sense. And certainly I'm a lot more forgiving of it now, knowing what the film was about.
Yeah. Yeah. So through this character, Eben, the artist, through his meetings with Jenny progressions, like, he's existing in 1934 during the Depression. She's existing between 1910 and 1925. Her death was 1925. And she talks about her parents as performers, as trapeze artists at what would have been the Rialto in 1934, but it was named something else during that time. So there's all these anachronistic things she's talking about that start hinting he's starting to pick up on, and he does kind of investigations in between. And first, he's just fascinated, and there's something, some quality about her he's quite taken with, and it inspires a sketch. And it's probably the first thing anybody's liked of his, and it energizes him, and he gets a decent amount of cash for it.
He got $25 for it, which is a lot of money in 1934.
Yeah.
And that, combined with the commission of the mural at the Irish pub,
yeah,
was sort of keeping him afloat, right?
Yeah.
And essentially keeping him alive.
And fairly comfortable, too. I think he was getting paid fairly decently for, or at least well-fed. Maybe he's getting free food during
that
whole time.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was getting his meals from the pub in exchange for the mural.
Yeah, so at least he's well fed. He's got $25 that maybe pay his rent. We really only see the rent lady a couple of times, and we really don't get closure on that part of the story, whether he's caught up and things are getting better for him. But as his fascination with Jenny grows, then turns into a romantic interest, he starts wandering away from his obligations at times, because he's so focused on her. And their orbits just revolve around each other. And these encounters are very strange, because they're periodic, and every time she's a bit older and a bit older. It's kind of weird. Like, I guess this is a romantic fantasy ghost story, maybe?
Well, I think that's what I love about the story.
Like, people debate. I was actually seeing if there was a definitive answer as to whether or not, you know, it's time travel or a ghost or what have you. And, like, there isn't really an answer. And in the book or in the movie, I feel like that's kind of one of the qualities that really makes it such a story that connects as well as it does.
Because it's so ambiguous, and that you can sort of interpret it however you choose to. Because when I first, halfway through, I'm going, is this a ghost story? Or is this a time travel, like you said? Or is it purely psychological? But he has too much detail on her life for it to have been a figment of his sort of imagination as a muse, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, honestly, when we were watching it, I also knew nothing about the movie going into it. And there's the one character who I think was his landlady. And earlier on, he's singing that song, and she's like, where'd you hear that song? And then, you know, earlier, he's like, oh, what are you looking at? And she's like, oh, you know, you look a lot like who I thought my ideal beau would be when I was a teenage girl. And so I really thought that they were going to make it like he's been in pursuit of this younger beauty who's actually his landlady, and by the time he finds out his landlady,
that wasn't his landlady. Was that? Are you talking Miss Spinney?
It might have been Miss Spinney.
Miss Spinney. She owns the art gallery. Matthews, and kind of becomes like this guiding hand for Evan, showing faith in him as an artist, because she didn't like the stuff she saw, but she bought one out of pity for the most part. But I think she saw potential in him, and Evan became this project for him, and she becomes a kind of a parental figure for him, but
and a mentor.
But I had very similar thoughts, like, is this an old Jenny that like we keep hearing her called Miss Spinney? But I mean, we do know what Jenny's full name was Jenny Appleton. So I'm like, well, maybe, but there are always these hints that she could be Jenny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right up until the end.
It didn't pay out that way, but which makes me curious about all of the hints, because, they do seem to be in there intentionally.
Yeah. They don't seem accidental, no. I mean, if they were accidental, then, hey, good job in misleading an audience.
Yeah. Great job in misleading an audience.
Yeah. But as a result of, like, these investigations that Eben's doing, Eben finds out she died in 1925. 10 years has passed since, like, he exists in 1935. She died in 1925. So it's a weird commentary on time existing around us in all forms. The past and the present are all accessible at the same time. I think that it's a fascinating story, and they don't try to overcomplicate it by trying to explain it, and it works. Like, you just accept that this is something strange is happening here, and it's pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, and that's what I like about it, is like it just is. There's no trying to rationalize it or give you a whole bunch of backstory on how it's happening. It's like, well, this is just what's happening.
Yeah,
do with it what you will, as the viewer, as the voyeur, as it were, of this story.
Like, in that sense, it kind of made me think about The Curious Case of Benjamin Button a little bit, just in terms of, like, here's a movie where, other than the fact that it has a fantasy element, is a pretty straightforward tale about somebody living their life in a period of time. Yeah, I really like stuff like that.
All right, well, I think now's a great time to run the trailer. This is a typical 1948 trailer where there's not a lot of dialogue and a lot of music, so enjoy the musical interlude with a little bit of dialogue.
Think people can know what lies ahead? I mean, what's going to happen to them?
Thank you.
right. That was the trailer for Portrait of Jenny, and I'm sure it told you absolutely nothing about this movie, but hopefully the clips that we're running during the episode as well will fill you in a little bit more, as well as our chat here. Based on the book by Robert Nathan, who also wrote The Bishop's Wife, which was adapted into film, and again readapted as The Preacher's Wife. So that was another book of his that became a popular movie that's been remade. This was adapted by Leonardo Bercovici, who adapted The Bishop's Wife for the screen. The screenplay was by Paul Orbison, who wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1941 version, and Peter Bernays, who wrote the screen adaptation for The Glass Menagerie from 1950. Uncredited was David O. Selznick, the producer of the film, who... he's got to get his fingers into everything. And usually you'll find this with most of his projects. There's some sort of uncredited for him somewhere. But he produced a lot more projects than he got like writing credits and directing credits for. But we have mentioned him before because he produced episode 78 for us. We talked about...
I didn't get it.
Oh, it was King Kong. Come on, we just came off our apocalypse.
But I don't look at producers.
Oh, well.
Yeah, he was actually... I was talking to Amelia that... it's interesting with this movie. It is a passion project of a producer, which you really don't see today at all anymore. Like, it's not the product of a director. It's not the product of a writer's vision. It's very obviously the producer.
Oh, it's kind of moving away from producers. But even then, like, even right into the 90s, you would see producers put over as much as directors. And writers are just getting, like, the better credit now. So,
yeah, Michael Bay is a good example of that, actually.
I can think of a whole bunch of them, but a lot of the 80s stuff as well, you know, and you get a new project from the producer of, and that's always a warning sign. Yep. Because you don't want to talk about anybody else. Uh-oh. There was also another uncredited writer on this movie was Ben Hecht, probably the most accomplished of writers on this list. He wrote the original Thing from Another World. Yeah, someday, guys. Scarface, the original.
Another someday, guys.
Another someday. And another movie we talked about, which was episode 155.
Again, didn't get it. I missed that.
That was Casino Royale. We talked about that classic James Bond movie.
We should switch the ships this week. I'm sorry.
That's all right. This was a really hard one to go through because this is like everybody in this movie fucking lived into their 90s and they had a shit ton of credits.
And also, no, 300, thank goodness. Like, tons of people worked on this movie at various stages of production. So tracking the cast and crew, or mostly the crew, it's a lot of work on this one.
It was. It took some time. Directed by William Dieterl, a German director who directed the classic Hunchback of Notre Dame from 1939, starring Jennifer Jones as Jenny Appleton. And she was acting fairly close to the end of her life and lived to the age of 90. Her last role was The Towering Inferno. So another big role for her. She always was in good stuff. Joseph Cotten played Eben Adams, and people might remember him from Soylent Green and the... probably the most famous movie of them all, Citizen Kane.
Nice.
Yeah, he's been in some really good stuff.
Yeah.
And he's such a good actor.
Really good actor. Ethel Barrymore was Miss Spinney, and she was in The Spiral Staircase. Lillian Gish was Mother Mary of Mercy, and she was in Arsenic and Old Lace, another fairly popular movie of the 70s. Cecil Kellaway was Matthews, and he was in The Postman Always Rings Twice. David Wayne was Gus O'Toole, the Irish taxi driver friend of Eben's. And he was in, this is great. He was actually in the Andromeda Strain, and we probably will talk about that someday. And Batman, the 66 television series, he was the Mad Hatter in that series.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, right? Albert Sharp was Moore, and I think Moore was the owner of the bar, the other Irish character. And he was in Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Oh, wow.
Right? I think that was his last role, actually. Henry Hull was Eek, and he was in Werewolf of London, which preceded the werewolf movies we've talked about, the Wolfman movies.
I love that movie.
Yeah, and it's a pretty cool movie. You should guys check that out. It's actually on the Universal Wolfman collection. So
that one's on my actual personal list of if I was to like, if I was ever in a Hollywood position, that one specifically would be on my list of movies I would try to remake. So. Mm-hmm.
You watch that movie, it feels more like a Jekyll and Hyde movie than a Wolfman movie, but I think it was pretty much the first werewolf movie made, so everybody should check it out. It's pretty cool. Felix Bressart was Pete, and he was in A Song is Born. Clem Bevins was Captain Cobb, and he was in Saboteur and Harvey. Harvey is about a animated bunny through the imagination of this dude, so I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I've always wanted to. One day. Maude Simmons was Clara Morgan, and she was in No Way Out. No, not that one. This one was from 1950. And that's our cast.
Yeah, and they all have huge credits. I was actually a little surprised that we didn't have any crossover at all, especially considering there were some names that I recognize, like Ethel Barrymore. I mean, she's a famous name, but even though her IMDb is quite short, she's a name that I recognize. And same with Lillian Gish. It's a name I recognize. And I'm like, I know this actress. She's quite famous. But again, her body of work was smaller than some of the other bodies of work for the supporting cast.
Yeah, they were like, I was the same way. I'm like, oh, I'm sure these are going to have some crossover in a couple of these. But I guess we've never come across them until now. But clearly, looking through some of their lists, this might be the first time, but maybe not the last time we talk about some of these guys.
There's a few of them that I think we're going to talk about again. There's something I wanted to mention after the trailer, but we went right into the casting, so I'm going to mention it now. I'm just wondering if anybody appreciates the irony of how dialogue-heavy this movie is. And there's almost no dialogue in that trailer. This movie is very much a dialogue film.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
There's actually one thing I noticed is definitely for me, like, it was a bit melodramatic, but people don't write romance movies with that kind of language anymore. Absolutely.
This time in filmmaking, with all the ones we've watched, I've always found that they kind of rely quite heavily on the dialogue and less on the visuals. I mean, this movie did a great job of doing both.
Yeah.
But yeah, movie making now is more about telling you the story through the visual as much as it is the dialogue. Yeah. But a lot of things come from the stage, sort of that whole stage mentality of it's about telling the story rather than showing the story.
Yeah, and this is a good example of being able to tell a compelling romantic story. And our audience knows the power of those words coming from my face. But telling a romantic fantasy story and still being able to experiment with some artful camera tricks. I mean, this is 1948, so things are fairly basic. We get the end camera tint that we talked about in Mighty Joe Young with the fire scene where they use the red filter to illustrate the warmth of that scene. Well, we've got the crashing waters of that tidal wave onto the lighthouse, and that scene's all in green for that cool and coldness. I think I probably would have gone with blue myself, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I think it's because, especially with hurricanes, the sky supposedly takes a green tint. Right? Yeah. So I think they're trying to sort of convey that, but it might have been just a little bit too green for just to make sure that visual effect was noticed.
But it's interesting because this movie is black and white for the most part. You get some shots when the narration's happening of Eben or whatever the scene is through what would be like a painting canvas, which is kind of fascinating. Like, you can imagine how that would kind of look these days, given something like What Dreams May Come, which was quite some time ago as well. But being able to make something look like a painting is well within our technology means now, and doing it compellingly. And it's something I'd like to retain because it was a really neat idea for scene transitions.
Oh, I really enjoyed that. Subject of the movie is about like a woman who gets painted as well. Like, metatextually, it works on a lot of levels.
Yeah, it certainly does. I certainly like what they did there. And then when we get to the end scene and it's all tinted in green, but there's one final shot where they're in the museum. We see Jenny's portrait hanging up in a museum, which was foreshadowed at the beginning through the opening narration of that film. When we close in on the painting, it's full Technicolor for the first time. We see color in this movie. It's the only time we see full color in this movie, which is actually a pretty powerful moment within a black and white film because you're not expecting it.
No, you're not. And it just really brings home the tragedy of the whole story because the story is a tragic, tragic story. But how that tragedy affects him and motivates him as well because part of the epilogue is talking about how his work up to that point was considered hackish and unappealing.
Yeah.
And then after his Portrait of Jenny, he goes on to this stellar career as an artist.
No, he doesn't. He dies. That is his one famous painting.
Or, sorry, stellar recognition, I guess, is the word I should have said. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that is it. And they, again, foreshadow that through conversation about other artists who weren't appreciated in their time would go on to being quite famous down the road, either one famous painting or several, but sometimes they only have the one famous piece that defines them. And it's a good way to foreshadow that this is probably going to happen with Eben, especially given the passion he's put into it. And that's something that Miss Spinney is really pushing him towards. It's like, well, there's no passion in these sketches when they first meet. She buys a flower just so he can go eat or whatever, but there's no passion in this. And when he does this first sketch based on his first encounter with Jenny in the park, there's a light in there. There's a life. And because she appears a little more out of time through her wardrobe and the thing she says, he's been able to translate that into the sketch. And now she starts to see his potential.
You actually brought up something that I wanted to mention, is, and I think this is sort of almost like the one of the most key moments in the film, is when they're at that first meeting, she's looking at his art, and she says, "I don't like it. Maybe you should paint something else."
Yeah, and that was a good way to go. It's like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be painting landscapes and flowers and things. There's the one painting, again, foreshadowed. This movie's full of foreshadowing. He's painted this lighthouse that they go to at the end of the movie, and with black waters and stormy clouds, and most people do not take to this well, especially Jenny when she sees it. She's very disturbed by it, probably because in the back of her mind, she knows this is the place she dies.
Exactly.
She feels somewhat disconnected. Sometimes she's connected to things she shouldn't know. Another time she can't connect to things that you think she might know. But it's very fascinating. I wrote her down as she just knows things. Like I made a note of that.
That was an aspect that I thought was super interesting, is a lot of, like, the more and more that he met Jenny, the more and more she carried on as if they had been carrying on a regular relationship, like talking about things as if they had never been apart and as if he had been there for those intervening, presumably missing years since the last time he's seen her. And that's something that she doesn't seem to be aware of, but he absolutely is. Like, she knows stuff, but at the same time, like, she mentioned, like, oh, you know, I told my one friend this thing, you know, what about this? And he's like, oh, that, you know.
Well, and she assumes that he knows things as well, because remember when they first meet, she talks about her best friend.
Who she hadn't mentioned yet, yeah.
And then the next time they meet, her best friend's name has changed.
Yes, because she's grown older, they've grown apart, she's got a new best friend.
Yeah, and the other friend has moved away, and she just kind of assumes that he would be aware of that. Mm-hmm. And you almost wonder if there's a subtext there, is that she is aware of him as he was growing, but he wasn't aware
but
of her.
But at the same almost. Not, it's, you know, yes and no. Like, and that's, again, part of the timeless quality of this, because there are times where they meet, and it's always the time where it's like, well, of course, I'm hurrying up on my growing up so we can be together. So she clearly is aware he was older than her when they first met. And she's in a hurry to age to be with him. And from his perspective, yeah, that's fucking happening. Yeah, exactly. She's having his whole life outside of him, of things she's unaware of, as when her parents died on the trapeze. And then she's been taken in by Mary, Mother of Mercy, and the nuns there, and raised despite not being part of that faith.
Well, and that brings up the whole mystery of it, too, is because a large part of this movie is sort of him discovering that she was a real person that was growing up 25 years before he ever met her. It talks about the mystery of her parents' death and what happened to her and where she went. And then he gets the connection later on because he finds out she was sent to the Catholic school or the nunnery even before she tells him about it. I like the mystery of it, where he's kind of trying to solve the mystery of Jenny as much as the love story.
No, I totally dug that as well. Oh, and then there's the scarf that becomes another big key in this film. She leaves this package behind with this scarf in it, and it keeps coming back as something. It's weird because she doesn't even recognize it later on, but I guess for her it was years and years and years ago, this package she never even got to open because she left it behind. So probably in her mind it was innocuous, but it was something tangible for him to hold on to that belonged to this person from the past that he's enamored with.
I was a little distracted when this happened, but I'm pretty sure I heard Mrs. Spinney. He showed her the scarf. She goes, "Oh, this is mine." Or is this mine? And she says something along those lines. And that refers back to some of the things that Jeff was saying about sort of that, those misdirects. Is like,
yeah,
was it hers?
Because when that scene happened, I definitely thought, like, I was like, oh, hey, here's when you find out that she's actually old Jenny. Because I think it was something where he was like, where'd you get that scarf? She's like, oh, this whole thing? It was just something that she had found where he had passed out.
Okay, that's right. I remember, yeah. So, but there was that moment of misdirect. Yeah, I knew there was something that where he kind of thought it was hers.
Yeah, she had found it at the site when they had rescued Eben. You know what? I said he died. He didn't die. He was rescued.
I didn't think he died. I don't remember them saying that. And there was an epilogue afterwards where they talked about how he went on to...
Yeah, he did go on to a good... He should have died. In my mind, he should have died.
Obviously, because you made it happen in your mind.
I did. I totally did. And even now, like, that should have been a Romeo and Juliet thing. That was the only way they could actually be together. So this weird love affair over time, which was just maybe a couple of weeks for him, and he's still going to carry that death for the rest of his life. That's terrible. Well, months, weeks, months.
Yeah, because there was that one point where she was gone for 3 months.
It brings in the other element that I think is maybe, like, what makes this movie hard to remake is the fact, like, how do you tell a story in which the female character only exists for the main character to be inspired to start his career. I mean, that's like incredibly cynical, but that's kind of how the movie shapes it. Like, it's because of that epilogue, that's kind of why the movie felt a little flat for me, or what was keeping it from being like great is like with the epilogue in the end, he was just a girl who he was enamored with for a few weeks and she helped him overcome writer's block. And you didn't really feel the weight of it being like this timeless love that they had, which I felt like they were going for.
Yeah, and I will say it made it fall flat for me, but I think that might be one of our first changes is maybe he does finish the painting and then dies of a broken heart kind of situation. This is only great work.
I think he should die in the tragedy with her personally.
And that would be a good way to
go as
well.
Which would be weird. You know, this guy dies 10 years before he, you know... It's weird, you know, if you lived in 1935, but you died in 1925, like, how do you even explain that?
Well, you don't, right?
That's the beauty of it, yeah.
Yeah, they don't explain anything, right? Yeah.
It would somewhat be appropriate because, like, he did wind up crossing into her time stream during that period. You always got the feeling hers was crossing into his before that. But this was the first time where he was racing out to the site of her death and hoping those days would merge like they have in the past. And he went to meet her in her time, not the other way around. Because she was going to meet her fate on her regular sailboat ride to this place. It did bug me because if she was afraid of the painting and then she went out to the sites anyway, like if... That painting was of this lighthouse that freaked her out over these waters that freaked her out, then maybe don't go there.
Yeah, but that always raises the question, like anything with a time travel sort of theme, is can you change the past?
Yeah. Well, right? And how much was she retaining of those meetings as well? Like, clearly the feelings and the memory of Eben were there. Even when she views the painting, there's a bit of, like, she gets disconnected by it, and maybe there's... deliberate blocking that out because this technically hasn't happened for her yet, but it is a dark foreboding thing for her.
And it's a future she can't change for her. Right. And then that you raise the really good question is he goes back to her time and there's that scene there where he's talking to her and Miss Spinney's actually there. She can't see Jenny.
Yeah.
So we almost wonder if he's sort of standing in both times at that point.
That's true.
Right. And I mean, I never thought of it while I was watching it, but as you mentioned, I'm like, I wonder if that's what was actually happening, is that he is actually standing in both periods of time.
And it's these kind of thoughts that make this movie stick with you because you just start thinking about it. Like, how does that work?
Yeah, you know, I was actually, this was another one of the movies, like similarly to Planet of the Apes, where I was like, I really tried to read this book before we did this remake. But by all accounts, I've heard that the book that the movie is based on is very incredible, and it's like 120 pages. It's like super short. It seems that what the book really, really does a lot is just, it's like tragic, and it's like longing, and the whole thing is like, you know, these questions that we're talking about seems to be the things that people meditate on after reading the book as well. So I think I definitely be tracking it down after we're recording.
Yeah. And this is like the skeleton of this film works fine. And the great thing about this is because of the timeless quality, you can really move this into any time. I really like the idea of like the setting of the Great Depression. And guess what? We're going to have one of our own fairly soon, if not already. It might be a good time to set it now. Although, personally, I kind of want to make the time stream a little longer. Maybe she existed in like 1985, because let's face it, people like the retro stuff. And so you could give everybody everything they kind of wanted out of this, as far as fan service to 80s and 90s and that sort of thing. The big hair and the fashion would be pretty cool.
Now, in today's day and age, this is another thing I was thinking about. Like, somebody who is an artist, the way he's depicted in that movie, maybe a little bit more common in the 30s than, like, a lot of artists now. Like, someone existing primarily as, like, a starving portraiture artist or landscape artist, I guess, does exist, but not to the same degree that it would have during...
Well, like, no. Our, like, the original. If you put it now, the problem with putting it now is there is a lot of means... as an artist, to sell your work, specifically online. So there's a lot more accessible ways to make money if you are a creative person.
And also
to
make art.
So the setting, and make art, yeah. So it's not quite the same anymore. You're almost working in this pretentious velvet buzzsaw era, right? And it's a lot of self-promotion. And does this critic see something in you because you didn't give him enough money, or you did? I don't know. I feel like most of these critics just get paid to give a good rating or something.
I was just thinking, because part of the conceit of the movie is that the portrait that he creates is like one of the all-time great paintings. At least that's how people talk about it. And it's like this great work that he's able to produce. But could a portrait that somebody paints capture the same imagination and attention like today as like when that movie came out?
That's the thing. Like, how much of modern artists have really popped outside of the art community? Honestly, the 80s might have been the last time somebody did. So maybe that would be a better time to set the movie.
And it addresses the sort of what you brought up about social media and online marketing and digital art and all these tools that people are using now to sort of create art.
That's assuming we even have to keep him an artist, but it seems like still the best way because it is the portrait of Jenny. He has to be a painter.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, unless you wanted to call it something like the Mystery of Jenny, and that, I think that kind of diminishes the story.
Yeah.
I think that her as his muse is really the core concept of the story, is that she inspires this person who didn't have any real inspiration. He had talent, but no inspiration. Mm. And that's a large part of what the story is. He wasn't emotionally connected to anything.
Yeah, and the moment he did, he was able to create better pieces.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things I would do as we were making it is still have that mural scene that he does, but have some of that inspiration show up in there, that this is one of the best big mural pieces that he's ever done, because Jenny's given him that inspiration, even though he kind of sets it aside for a while.
Yeah, and that bugged me when he's literally finishing it, touching it up on the final day of the reveal, and then just walks away like he doesn't give a shit about this. So people shouldn't have liked it, given how his dispassion was portrayed earlier in the film. That did kind of bug me. Granted, it might have been a bunch of drunk people who didn't know it was a shitty painting, but
but no, I would like to sort of show his progression as an artist through that as well. Like, it's not up to Portrait of Jenny, but I think if you're sort of do your epilogue, it's like, is one of what's considered these two great pieces is this mural that he did at this pub, is considered sort of the burgeoning of his art, and then
it made this pub world famous.
Yes, yeah, I think that would make his transition to sort of this sort of iconic piece that much stronger, I think.
Yeah, I kind of like his immediate social circle, his friends at the bar with Gus. The rest, like, you can switch people around if you don't want have Jenny going to a nunnery. Fine, she could go to some other foster home or whatever. When her parents died, she was probably high school level anyway. So it would have only been a few years before she was on her own anyway, to going to college.
Yeah, and I mean, they reference her aunt having sent her to the nunnery.
That's true.
To get an education. But you could change that and just have her sent to a foster care system.
Yeah, or we just use the ant. We don't actually ever meet the ant.
Yeah,
but exactly. We hear about the ant. So maybe instead of talking to Sister Mary of Mercy, you talk to her aunt instead. Sometimes I feel like the intro, I'm like, oh, and you feel like this might be a Catholic or Christian type of movie. Thankfully, it's not near as heavy-handed of that. The intro kind of makes it feel like it's a high faith movie, but
yeah,
it doesn't really.
I would not open a remake with two quotes. That was a little pretentious.
I thought so too. I'm like, oh wow, we got two quotes breaking up the narration on top of it. That was like, okay. And then you go from the narrator who never really comes back to the monologue voiceover in his head of Eben, yeah, starting his story. So I'm like, oh, here's some more narration from somebody else. I'm like, all right, pick a storyteller here. We don't need both. But again, that was 1948.
Actually, you know, I was reading that night. This did not even occur to me at all until I was reading it this morning. But that movie, when it came out, was highly unusual for not having opening credits.
Right.
And I didn't even think about it. They just had the opening, like a guy comes down to tell you that you're about to learn a lesson and give you some quotes.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. And they did wind up having credit cards, which is unusual too for the era. Yeah. I didn't think about that.
Yeah. No, they mentioned it in the trivia on it. I didn't read a lot of it, but that was one thing that kind of stuck out was that, yeah, exactly what Jeff just mentioned is that it was one of the first films to forego opening credits just to get you into the story. I mean, it's pretty common practice now. So, but yeah, back then it was highly unusual.
Okay, so have we settled on an era here? Where do we want to set our remake?
I think I like your 80s idea, to be honest with you. I think that it allows us to still have him be like the struggling artist, and it gets rid of, like you said, some of the challenges we would have with the new business model of being an artist.
Well, and here's the thing too. So if he's existing in the 80s and maybe he's trying to do crappy pop art. did the Campbell suit can, and they're like, oh, somebody got there first.
Because, you know, I think that there needs to be some sort of, there needs to be an additional lesson. He doesn't need to make what he thinks he should be making as an artist. He needs to make what he wants. Like,
yeah,
he needs to make,
and I think,
you know, art that is true to himself.
Yeah, and I think him trying to do what the pop art is at the time is what's holding him back and being criticized for. And going back to a more classic style and passionate about his work would work really well for the character. And it gives us a good time frame too, because if we're thinking, okay, 20, 25 years back, so Jenny would be 1960-ish, right? So yeah, we've got Vietnam we can work with.
Yeah.
What else do we got we can work with? That would be great for parents, maybe.
Yeah,
there's the whole free love thing. There's the whole like 1969 with the Manson murders and Woodstock and 1970, and there's a lot to play with. There's like the whole huge paradigm shift of like culture, where America getting into the 80s was finally starting to have like money in excess that they didn't know what to do with.
In a way, this would be similar to what Tarantino just did of his love letter to the kind of death of classic cinema of the 60s, which ended with the Manson murders with his. We can kind of do that in a way of how it affects art, how it affected the people of the time, how it changes Jenny existing in that time, maybe losing a parent to Vietnam and living under the fear cloud.
Art direction. You could easily have something like, you know, a lot of people feel like Vietnam specifically was like a big turning point for America that really took away a lot of people's optimism. And you could even have something as simple as he lives in a world where people are fairly cynical and he's an artist and he meets somebody who's from a time where people still have like hope for the American dream.
Yeah.
And that would be actually interesting, because that awakens him as she's starting to catch up with him, and the changing of the times starts affecting her, and he has to renew her optimism as well.
I like that, and that's actually, I was just about to mention something very similar, is you can sort of see her become sort of more jaded like after like 1969, because I'm assuming that she'd sort of going 60 to 75-ish, right? So that you can sort of see as she's maturing into an adult, she's also deeply affected by what's happened in her world.
Oh, that could be really interesting. Renewing her faith and optimism and keeping that love alive between the two of them as well, because we could maybe see it fracture at some points because of the things she's experienced that he hasn't. Or he's already gone through and come around because of her.
Yeah, and I mean, you have that opportunity for her to say something like, well, the only thing that gives me hope is you.
Yeah. I mean, they had
they
even had the opportunity in the original film, really, considering how many hardships he's gone through. But she still remains, for the most part, very happy and optimistic, especially to be with Abin. And if something kind of bums her out, it's like, no, sit down and start your painting, and you're going to be famous for this painting. And she's always helping build him up as well. And it's like, don't worry about me. I have my target, and it is to grow older by every second.
Right. And it's interesting because I just realized that in her original setting at 1910, she would have gone through the First World War.
Yes.
Yeah.
So moving it forward to the 60s, that we still keep that sort of – and that was never mentioned in the movie.
No.
Right? But I think that we could use that to
great effect. I think that's less stupid than trapeze artists.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and I would say something
– But they would have been a thing
in 1910. I would also probably make her older from the onset, just to kind of remove the ick factor a little bit of guy meeting a 12-year-old and falling in love with the span of
– Well, he's just fascinated by her. He's like, well, he's like, oh, interesting kid. And he doesn't until she starts to age a bit.
Mm. Do you think that it would be more effective? So just as a personal preference, I think if I was to do a remake, I would like shorten the gap of how much she ages. If that makes sense. Like, she's still aging, like maybe over a period of like maybe not 10 years, but I don't know.
It was 15 years. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, because she was a precocious child. And I felt like she was probably, they were aiming around like 11, 12. Because mm-hmm. right? She'd been through college when she died.
Yeah.
Right? So she would have been 24, 25.
Yeah, I'd say she would have been about 25 when at her death. And that was, by that point, their timelines were about 10 years apart.
So, I mean, we could tighten it up a little bit, but then we're putting her in the, even just by a couple of years would make a difference, but...
I don't think that matters so much.
No.
We're not going to get too nitpicky about that. But I think, most movies go with fives and tens because it's easy math on the audience, right? But because they figure that one guy in the audience who is doing the math and not paying attention in the movie. We don't fucking care.
It's about the story, not the math.
Yeah.
But I have no objections to him meeting her as a 10 or 11 year old. I have no problem with that. Certainly.
I would maybe make it 13, 14. That's what I, as the movie started, I thought she was around 15 in the first meeting, which, I mean, they never say her age, but you do. If you start doing the math, then it's like, I think they were probably aiming more for like 12.
I kind of got that impression just by the way she was dressed as well.
But she just looked a little too big and a little too old for 12.
Yeah. And that's where you sort of do what we'd normally do now is for that particular part of the film, you would cast a younger person.
Yeah.
Right. And then the next meeting, you meet the maturing one.
Yeah. I think they did a good job with camera trickery and angles and that sort of thing, putting Eben on higher ground and whatnot to make her look smaller. They did a very good job with that. But modern technology can even do it more. So if you find an actress who's still like, hey, maybe she's in her 30s, but she can play like early 20s. I mean, how often do we see 30-year-olds playing like high schoolers? Happens a lot.
The movie at the time was like this huge budget spectacular. I imagine that, I mean, especially the way that movie special effects are going, you could digitally de-age someone and, you know, within a couple of years and it not break the bank in the same way that it would, a couple of years ago.
And they have done that numerous times now. I mean, look at The Irishman. Right? I mean, they didn't de-age them to children, but they did do it, right? So there's no reason that we couldn't do something similar.
Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. in, Captain America Civil War, they de-aged him down to about 16 years old, and it looked very good.
Yeah, I mean, the de-aging's getting better. I don't like relying on it. Even with The Irishman, I didn't think it looked great. But I mean, actually, it looked really good for the most part, but the problem is they were de-aging. Instead of using actors and putting the faces over younger people, they were de-aging the 80-year-olds. So,
yeah.
You know, here's a guy who's supposed to be mid-30s and still walks like he's 75, 80 years old. So that was a big problem with The Irishman for me. But as far as the effects go, they worked really well.
Yeah, you could easily do a story like Portrait of Jenny today with our special effects and do it in a way that would look good and it wouldn't be cheesy.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could probably easily find an actress if you wanted to in that part and cast that way. But if you find that actress, for the most part, who can play from 20 to 30 or around 25 and late teens or whatever, you're probably pretty good for the most part. I mean, this movie did it fairly effectively, so...
Oh, yeah.
It's not like you can't use the same trickery here as well. And with the computer touch-ups, you can just make it far more convincing in that regard.
Yeah, because, her performance is what sold it, right?
Yeah, I love the idea of playing with, like, the 60s and 70s fashions for her while he exists in this gaudy 80s. And the fact that she doesn't actually notice it, how weird it is, because we never see her comment on things like fashions and the changes, because I don't think she sees it. In her movie, like from her perspective, it's still 1910, 1915, 1925. We never see her but I guess they never position her in a way where she can see something anachronistic from her perspective.
Well, that's the thing is, especially then, men's fashion didn't change very much. You wore a suit, a tie, and a hat.
Yeah.
I mean, the ties might have gotten wider or thinner, or the shoulders might have gotten wider, lapels, whatever, but I mean, unless you're looking for those things, you're not necessarily going to notice. Mm-hmm. Whereas in our setting, it will be noticeable, and that might be a device we can sort of use.
Yeah, we can certainly have some fun with
that. I feel like you could either, not bury the lead at all and have it, she's obviously out of time the first time that he sees her, or you could try to mislead a little bit and have him not realize that she's aging as rapidly until maybe the third time that they meet.
Yeah, I like the hints, like the subtleties of it. Like watching a 1948 movie for the first time in 2020, like, I don't know what the fashions are in 1920, really, like outside of a film or whatever and photography. Like, so I didn't pick up on the fact that what she was wearing in that first meeting was out of time until Eben said so to his friends. So that was interesting. And then you start picking on. I'd like to just keep it subtle, let it build. And that's why they think this movie works so well, is the subtle building of it. And when you start questioning it, you're questioning everything along with Eben, because you're learning it as he's learning it.
Yeah. And that is what makes it work.
Yeah. And if you're really perceptive, you might catch on a little earlier.
And the other thing I think that we should sort of, as we're remaking it, is make sure that we focus on that mystery, and because he investigates it. But I felt that was sort of almost too fast in the movie.
Yeah, they can take a little more time. This movie's only 89 minutes, and I felt like they could take a little more time with that as he looks at, because sometimes you got to go and dig through libraries and old newspapers and that sort of thing, and it all happens really quickly in here. And you could extend some of those interviews as well, so he could find out a little bit more about Jenny and the people who may have interacted with them or who knew the history. And that is a lot of what these secondary characters, like Eek, Eek was the lighthouse guy, but like Mary Mother of Mercy and Pete's and Captain Cobb, and they all have their little stories or connections to Jenny or Jenny's family, right?
Yeah, and I like to see more sort of show that she has an impact on everybody she meets.
Yeah, because right? She's got such a warm personality.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of focus on that, as he's talking to people who knew her when she was 12, when she was 15, when she was 20. All of them feel like that she enriched their lives somehow. I think that'd be kind of a really nice way of sort of moving it forward to how she's, even in out of time, she is still affecting people's lives.
Yeah, you do get a little sense, like that guy at the Rialto had some stuff there, knew some stuff, or knew somebody who knew more. And
the nun.
So you could see how, just in the way they talk about this person, Jenny, that these people were affected by Jenny and genuinely liked her. And by giving those scenes a little more time to play out, you don't need much, like minute, 2 minutes here, 2 minutes there. It'll add up as the movie goes along. That'll flesh that out a little bit more. And these people need to be important too, so you get a sense of that person as well. And even with his friends like Gus and more, just I enjoyed those characters and I would have just liked to have more with them as well.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of see them sort of recognizing the change in him as well. Because, I mean, Gus kind of does when he visits him at his studio the one time. But that's the only sort of time where his inner circle sort of recognizes that something's happening to him.
Well, Miss Spinney kind of sticks with him and is there to kind of push him along as well.
She recognizes it.
I like her, like, this subdued caringness about it. And I still think there's a key there. Like, part of me wants to end this in tragedy, and part of me wants her to be Jenny.
You know what you mean.
This couple that can never be apart, which means she would have had to exist much earlier than she does. Or, again, Miss Spinney's out of time. She's like, okay, if this was 1945, like, this version of her is from, like, the 70s.
Yeah, sorry, my cat just jumped up on top of the table. My mic was on, so.
Okay. I'm torn with having them live or die. I mean, I guess the story's most effective with Jenny being dead.
Well, I was wondering, I guess where I thought it was going was that, like, you know, the older lady would be Jenny, but he wouldn't discover it until after she had died, was where I thought it was going. Like, he had the time with her, but he was ignoring her in the pursuit of, you know, her when she was younger. You know, didn't realize what he had in front of him until it was too late. That's kind of, yeah. If she was going to be Jenny, that's how I would want it to resolve.
If nothing else, the misdirection is kind of nice to keep you on your toes. Mm-hmm. I think they were doing too much to make you think she was Jenny.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I pull it back just a little bit.
Yeah, I really enjoy her being a mentor character. That was another relation we see build, and maybe he's unaware of how much he's not alone in the world anymore, even without Jenny.
See, and I kind of got that from the film, is he's has a support network with or without Jenny that he didn't have before. And that's what all these characters are.
He starts the film with nobody, and his whole support structure he meets over the course of the movie. I was thinking for a remake, I think that one thing I probably would like to see is, like, there's the one point in the movie where, you know, he can't get hired at all, like, near the beginning, and he gets hired to do this mural. And then when he's pursuing Jenny, he kind of just abandons it a little bit, and they're like, hey, come on, you know. And it kind of feels like a bit of a dick move on his part, because, like, they're the reason that he's still alive, because they're feeding him and literally putting food in his mouth. I would kind of maybe want to start off the movie similarly, where he gets a job doing art, but it's like the type of art that he's trying to sell that isn't as successful, like at an ad agency or something. And I feel like there has to be somebody pushing him to not change his art, as well as him wanting to change for Jenny, or Jenny encouraging him to change. Because I feel like that's a lot more realistic as an artist.
That could be compelling, too, because there really isn't an antagonist in this movie.
Well, it doesn't need to be.
Would be interesting. Not a hard and fast villain, but him maybe being torn from this commercial work that's steady, but he doesn't give two shits about and is just breaking his soul the longer he does it. And this mentor character who's pushing him to take risks and move out of his mold, which Jenny's also trying to do, and rather than the safety of a paycheck.
You could almost switch Matthews over to that character, right? Like, maybe he's the director of an ad agency that Evan does work for.
That would be good. Really, having both of them there was counterproductive. It was just, okay, Matthews works for Miss Spinney, and he's just a little harsher with his criticism.
Instead he can be like, no, this is what you need to be doing. This is commercial. This is going to sell your Campbell's soup. Name dropping. This is going to sell your Kraft dinner. This is going to sell your Campbell's cigarettes. Right. So he's basically just copying other people's art to sell something.
Because you could even have the thing at the beginning where someone's like, there's no passion in it. And, you know, you can be technically, an incredible draftsman working for an ad agency and there be not an ounce of humanity in your work. Like, the mechanical aspect of some commercial art. Yeah, it's like he would have to, him wrestling with already having made it as an artist, like, he's working where he wants to work, but he's not finding fulfillment as an artist, which is where Jenny comes in. I think is like a lot meatier to latch on to.
Yeah, his first meeting with Gus, how'd your day go? If I have to draw a ketchup bottle again, I'm going to kill myself.
you have some of that stuff, especially in the 80s when, like, that's when marketing really, really took off. It was the age of consumerism.
Yeah, it totally was. Reaganism was all about consumerism and pushing that agenda.
Yeah, and I think that would be a really good device. So yeah, he's a successful draftsman, but he's not a successful artist.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah, and I think Matthews would be good at moving him into that role as sort of the guy who's saying, no, you're a good draftsman. We want you to keep doing this. And Miss Spinney sees that he has the potential to do something so much more.
And this commercial work's just killing his soul.
It's killing him. Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe that first work at the bar is just where he can start being creative again, just for the fun of it, because he wants to help his friends out at this bar.
Totally. Exactly, yeah. And Gus is always
pretty true to me and artists that I know.
Yeah, and Gus is always telling him, you need to be doing your own stuff. And he kind of tricks him into doing the mural, almost like he did in the original, where he takes him for lunch and then kind of works the owner into letting Eben paint the mural, right? But instead, the owner and Gus trick Eben into doing the mural.
Yeah, and it's like it might not be... You know, like he has his job, but he might not be getting paid as much for the mural, but at least it's something he likes.
No, that's cool. I want to change the ending too, though. The original book, I guess, ends on a cruise ship.
Hmm.
But the problem is that puts a whole lot of other people within that scene.
Yeah.
And Eben's trying to, although it would be pretty action-packed if he got to do, like, hey, a boat sinking.
Yeah. I mean, I think the location of the ending is okay, but I think I agree with you that having him only have sort of the one great work and the one that sort of showed his potential.
Well, okay, wait. We need something of his own work that kind of trips Jenny's senses, because she always goes back to that painting every time she sees him again, and she's looking through his work, and every time she sees that stormy lighthouse, her mood gets really dark. Well, so we still need something like that.
Insurance company or something, right? Like something that sort of... would you have sort of that sort of foreboding feel about it. It's like, get your insurance now because you never know when the storm's coming, kind of a ad that he's done this piece for.
That could work, yeah. It's kind of funny.
do you think that, I was actually thinking, like, if we're going to update it to the 80s, do you think that it would make more sense for it to be like a plane crash?
Ooh, yeah. Because... And you can see him maybe doing a commercial airline ad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If she's looking through his ad work and just maybe an airplane ad sparks something in her.
Yeah. The trick is, how do you get them into that same time and space? Like because the beauty of the lighthouse was that it was secluded and it was easy to cross them over, because even though they were different times, he was still somehow traveling to that time. How do you get them both onto a plane?
Oh, how do you get him to survive it?
Yeah.
As well.
I don't think we do. I think I agreed with you on that he doesn't survive it.
Yeah, and it has that one great work, and he gets the fame he was wishing for, dreaming about, wanting to be a famous artist.
Or true artist.
Or even, true right? artist, yeah.
Because, like, you could have something where... You could have it maybe similarly, but he wouldn't see her again is the only problem. If you were to have him go to the site of where her plane crashed, and then there's another plane crash... maybe it's unrelated, maybe it's the time stream or whatever, but he dies because he's at the location.
Well, and so you lose that powerful moment. That's the biggest thing, is you lose that powerful moment where he tries to save her.
Yeah.
When, as the audience, you know full well that he can't. So we have to figure out a device.
You have to also get him on a plane that flew 10 years prior, or get him on a plane that's flying the same route at the same time over the same spot.
Well,
that puts him into her path.
What if she didn't die in the plane crash, but she was killed by a plane crash?
Mm.
That seems a little less likely if the plane landed on top of you while you're walking your dog.
Well, no, I mean, you'd have to put her in a situation where it would be possible, right? Be that at an airport.
Right.
That could work, is you have her at one of those little local airports where a plane did crash and kill her. And he goes back to it. It's abandoned now, right? So it kind of gives you that same sense as a lighthouse.
Right.
And it allows him to be alone when this all happens. Yeah. So he can have that moment where he tries to save her.
I get the feeling they didn't do the cruise ship thing for budgetary constraints. And I mean, it was already expensive enough to shoot on location in New York. So maybe that was just a cut back on an already overbloated budget on this movie. But yeah, that would work. That would make for an exciting ending as well.
Yeah, but it would modernize it a little bit. And yeah, and I mean, certainly in 1975, you would have a lot more of these smaller local airports rather than these huge, massive international airports that are a lot more common.
Yeah, especially also in like the mid-70s is when you kind of start to see an upswing in like airport terrorism too. Not that they would go in that direction, but that's the kind of stuff that started happening more in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, a crash at an airport, you'd be able to find records of that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, I think that that would be on a plane, yeah.
She was there to meet her aunt, who was on the plane. Except we were going to use the aunt, but...
Yeah, but you can make it an aunt and an uncle. That's a fairly easy fix. But I like that, is that she wasn't actually going on the plane, but she was there to meet somebody.
Hell, maybe the plane crash killed her parents. That's the moment her parents died.
Yeah.
She died outside waiting for the plane, because it's not like a big airport type thing, and they probably let her wait outside like they would as they disembark, maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how we get her there, or maybe it crashed right into the small airport that would have existed.
And that's where I was going with it, is, yeah, it actually crashes into the airport, and that's why it's now closed, and that's why it allows him to go there and experience that her final moments with her.
Mm-hmm. They'd still have that isolation if we kept it outside of like a small town or something like that. Yeah, that would work. That'd give for a fairly exciting ending.
So sad.
Why do we have to keep making it sad? Does it have to be sad? Yeah.
Let's do a remake in which they both get together and nothing bad happens. And it's just a movie about their happy life with no quarrels.
Oh, so you want to make a romantic comedy?
Never.
Actually, Amelia was saying that because it's a little bit about a ghost, she's like, you could do a horror remake of this movie.
I was thinking that we might go that way, but I like the story as it is. I like the way it makes me feel, and going the horror direction almost undermines what's actually happening.
Because it is a really, really nice... like story. Like, I feel like anybody can identify with like longing to be with somebody or feeling like there's nobody in this world for you. And the movie kind of tackles both of those pretty well.
And that longing to be more than you actually are for a lot of people. And that longing to be inspired for anybody who's at all creative. That's always kind of a thing that's like, well, what's going to inspire me next?
Exactly. Okay, well, I think we're ready to start doing our casting for Portrait of Jenny here. And guess what? Trish is finally awake and joined us. Hi, Trish.
Hi, guys. I made it.
You have no idea how we just remade this movie. But before we get into casting, just give us some quick thoughts of what you thought about this movie.
It was much different than I actually anticipated. I really liked it. Yeah, it was very, very different. It was like the Time Traveler's Painter. Is what it was, instead of the Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, I'd heard it compared to Somewhere in Time as well, with sort of the Lovers Out of Time kind of story.
Yeah. But yeah,
Time Traveler's Painter is a really good way of putting it.
The Time Traveler's Painter. Because she keeps coming. It's like, maybe Rachel McAdams should be in this. I just don't know. There's no other way. She keeps doing time travel movies.
Yeah, it's a weird one to keep getting caught in, but...
Yeah, I know. Well, there's lots of people you notice, look through their career, you'll find little notes. But yeah, no, I kind of looked at it. It was like really enjoyable. Like I liked the fact that I don't know if I would keep it. I would like to bring it forward in now times, but I might leave it back because it's a slow burn to find out what happened.
Well,
whereas today with technology, it's harder to hide that stuff.
And we came up with that as well. And we kind of met in the middle and put Eben in the mid-80s, which puts her in the 60s into the 70s as far as her timeline goes, which gives us Vietnam War to play with a little bit and other events like the Manson family murders and how it changed a generation in a very short period of time.
Oh, yeah. Vietnam and the 80s and the 60s. I mean, you've got the hippie free love, get rid of the establishment. And the 80s is like greed and shoulder pads. And
yeah, she gets it.
Yep, she gets it. She's all over it.
Totally.
Yeah. I love it, you guys.
You got to listen to the rest of the episode to see how we filled it out, but...
I do. I have one thing that I was thinking of, and it only came to me about an hour after I watched it, and it was sort of like, I made two casts. I cast an Eben and an Evan. One is male, one is female, because I was like, I was wondering if it wasn't that they were stuck in time because they couldn't find the right person in the right time because of society.
Oh, that's an interesting commentary. Mm-hmm. We didn't even think about that sort of thing either.
Ah.
Yeah, that would make it kind of like that episode of Black Mirror a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where that came from in my head. That's probably subconsciously where I was at.
No, that's a really, really good take, actually.
Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, what was your thought? Sorry, one more thing. On the green... All of a sudden, everything goes green and the hurricane comes.
Well, I mean, as far as the green goes, this was very similar to what they did at the end of the original Mighty Joe Young, where it went all red. I think to put coolness and coldness into the scene, blue probably would have worked better for that emotion. But at the same time, Sam brought up that the clouds sometimes in major storms will have a greenish tinge to them. So maybe that's why they picked that filter. It looks, as far as the actual scene goes, it looks great for being a constructed set, which makes it very expensive. But instead of doing it on location, which would have been a much probably harder to shoot because you can't control the motion and get those crashes. So they built an entire set and it looked great.
Oh, yeah. It looks amazing. Beautifully done.
I think that's what it was. But the fact that the movie uses black and white and then a color filter and then an actual full color scene, Technicolor scene right at the end is pretty unique, actually.
Cool.
Because a whole lot of different methods. But yeah, we did bring it up. And now we're going to get into some casting since we've got a fairly good idea of how we would remake this movie. I think we all agree the general skeleton of this movie works really, really well. So we've kind of changed the setting. We've now made Eben a commercial artist who is just like his job is beating him down and he's
killing his soul.
Killing his soul. No passion for what he's doing. And that's how Jenny uplifts him, as well as Miss Spinney, trying to pull him away from this commercial work and to something he's a little more passionate about, and Matthews being his boss in our version, trying to keep him in the commercial art game.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that's kind of that was kind of our general structure. I think his friends in the bar still work, and investigating her history as he meets her along the way. Maybe set pieces will change depending on the city or whatnot, and the parks and whatever. And we even discussed at one point where because of the era Jenny's living through, and her maybe disillusionment from moving from the 60s into the 70s, and then Eben, as he's been uplifted by her, gets to do the same for her.
Nice.
So
there. I love that
idea. That's the quick version for it, but let's get into some casting. Jeff, why don't you start us off?
I had one more question.
Oh, go ahead.
I was reading some trivia on it, and they said in the book, other people can see her, and in the movie, it seems like he's the only one who can. Did you land on anywhere with that?
No, actually, I don't think any of us picked up on, did a lot of reading on the book, but we did mention that Miss Spinney can't see her. I think we've kind of kept that in our version as well, as far as not seeing her.
Yeah, it's less about people not seeing her. It's just you don't put them in situations where they do, or like there might be people around, but it's like in The Sixth Sense where he's around and it's just nobody's acknowledging he's there. But you don't ever have to talk about it.
Crowded place, people don't look. It's New York. They don't.
Yeah, like, if people are aware of her, they're not acknowledging that she's there. And maybe because of that out of timeness of her character is what's keeping from people from perceiving her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
That would be kind of cool. I mean, we all agree we love the ambiguousness of the original film where they don't try to explain it. And it doesn't need to be explained. I think that's why it works, to be honest, as long as you don't make it too confusing and keep the rules consistent that you've already established, then you're fine. And I think that works fine. Maybe we
magic
have the,
is good.
Yeah, maybe we have the, and that's part of it. It is a magical fantasy romance. And once you start explaining, it takes the magic away. So just, it is what it is. Something weird is happening and he's gradually becomes aware of it. I think that works just fine.
Nice.
So Jeff, do you got any casting for us?
So I think that for Jenny, my pick would be Alexandra Daddario, just because I was trying to think of actresses who are very striking. And one thing that's very striking about her is she has very intense eyes. And I think in terms of like a film treatment, any like painting depiction of anybody who has very striking eyes is going to connect more as something that you'd buy as being as big as they're saying that it is. And also she's very beautiful. She's very funny. You know, she's a pretty good actress. She's not in a ton of stuff,
but she could portray that energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And she, I think that we were talking about with various effects and stuff. I think she could play younger and older, you know, and she's, I think, in her late 20s or early 30s.
Yeah, and you need somebody who's in that age group who can play younger and older as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that for my Eben, probably would be I think Jake Gyllenhaal would be a good character for that kind of role.
That's funny. I almost
did that. Me too.
Yeah, I think that he's been really proving himself as an actor these past couple years, and he hasn't been getting a ton of, well, all the roles he's been getting have been very interesting. There's just not tons of them. But yeah, I think he could portray that kind of artist, you know, struggling, working for an ad agency.
Now that I'm looking, I'm like, my lead actor might actually still be too old for this part. But so Gyllenhaal,
that's kind of what I was thinking too.
Gyllenhaal might be a good substitute for that for sure. What else you got?
Well, I was thinking kind of over the course of the movie that we were talking about anyway. I mean, I guess in the original movie, his supporting cast of like core friends are really important to him. But like, really, you could, like, I don't have anyone specific in mind for those parts because their parts would be kind of different. Mm-hmm. So I really, really thought of like the casting for the main two characters. I was thinking that if you were to go for like a director on this movie, I kind of think that it's like a romance, but also it's like a tragedy. And I can't see why a director like David Fincher couldn't like maybe pull off a lighter side, but kind of having like a sensibility of everything kind of being hopeless a little bit, if that makes sense. Yeah. And yeah, I think that would be an interesting subject matter for him to tackle, especially because he's been getting more into kind of more pared down type stories like Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. And he's been working a lot with Gillian Flynn, who also, you know, if they were to team up and work on this movie, I think that it would work out pretty okay.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Like a bit light for them, but I think that they both have evidence in their careers that they could do it. So,
yeah. Okay, Sam, why don't you go next here?
Okay, I'll go next. So I went a little bit younger with my Eben because I felt that she was waiting till she was in her mid-20s for that moment where they could be together. So I went with Nicholas Holt as our struggling artist. I thought that he'd do a really good job of playing sort of the struggling artist. But even with the changes we've made, I could see him sort of being that character who's frustrated with the corporate world and just wanting to explore being an artist, but not knowing how to get there. For my Jenny, I was thinking of somebody who could play almost the entire age range, if not all of it, and who, again, like Jeff said, somebody who's kind of striking. So I went with Zendaya.
Okay.
Yeah, because she's 22 right now. And yeah, with makeup, you could make her look, obviously, you can make her look like a teen. And again, with makeup, you can make her look 25, 26 without any problem.
Well, she's playing a teenager in Spider-Man, so.
Exactly. Right.
yeah.
Exactly. And then we have a Spider-Man connection there because of Jeff's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes.
Yep.
And I only cast four characters because I only felt they were four sort of main characters that sort of really needed be sort of cast. I did cast Miss Spinney. I was Diane Keaton. I thought she would be a lot of fun in sort of that kindly mentor role.
I like that. Yeah.
And then Trish is going to love my Matthews. I went with Bill Nighy.
Nice.
I think he's even better as the sort of overbearing boss kind of character.
He actually did play a curator. He played a curator on an episode of Doctor Who. Brief scene, but so I can totally see him doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I thought that would be a lot of fun to have him in there. And then for my director, I wanted somebody who sort of has that sort of auteur feel to the way he does his work and makes really good use of color. So I went with Yorgos Lanthimos. I can't say his name properly, he's the guy who directed The Lobster.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And that's a great
I think
movie.
That he would, because he also knows how to sort of handle romance really well. So I thought, yeah, you know what? I think he'd be a really good fit for this type of film.
Very cool. Well, I'll let Trish go last since she was last in. She can be last out the door. So for my casting, and I'm shooting because this movie did get nominated for a couple of Oscars and one for special effects, although I don't think there was a special effects category in 1948, so it was probably a special award for this film. But for my casting, for Jenny, and again, I think everybody was kind of shooting for that person who can play young and old and somebody out of time. And this actress has already done it. I went with Samantha Robinson from The Love Witch and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Nice.
Yeah. And she's got those striking features and much respect, similar features to Jennifer Jones. For Eben, I went with Ewan McGregor. Now, he's a little older than I think I'd like for the part, but I think he would be exceptional in the part as well.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a perfect movie right there. Ewan McGregor is in it.
Wait, it gets better because I am shooting for Oscars in this movie. For awesome. for my supporting cast, I went with John Malkovich as Matthews.
Also very good. Nice.
You're just going for the Jeff ballot on this one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was thinking about him in Velvet Buzzsaw, so I'm like, I can have a connection to another movie about paintings.
Oh, I have a link there too.
For Miss Spinney, as much as I'm not a big fan, going for that Best Picture Award, Meryl Streep.
Nice. I think she'd be good as Miss Spinney.
I think she would be fabulous as Miss
Spinney. I think she would be, yes.
For his friend Gus, the Irishman, I went with Colin Farrell.
I was going to do that, and I'm like, nah, you know what? I'll just sort of leave that up to chance.
Well, that's exactly what I cast.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Are there any other Irish actors? No, I'm just kidding.
There are.
That dude on Preacher.
He's really good.
And for Mary of Mercy, even though we've kind of ditched her character in favor of an aunt or an uncle, I went with Kathy Bates.
Sweet.
Nice.
Yeah. For my director, I went with Mark Forster, who did Monsters Ball, Quantum of Solace, World War Z, but most notably, I think, movies that I felt were similar in tone with a more magical feel to them, like Christopher Robin and Finding Neverland.
Totally.
Nice.
So when I thought about those two movies, I'm like, that's kind of the feel I see this movie having as well, except less Winnie the Pooh.
Great picks.
Thank you, Jeff. It's nice to know my audience will have one person in it.
But as comforting as Winnie the Pooh.
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking big. I'm like, well, this movie flopped at the box office, but it was a big production with a big movie. And like, I'm like, well, you know, like, I think it still deserves that. Like, I think it still deserves that quality and that kind of push. I still think it could be a well-recognized movie given the chance.
Yes.
And I think that for everything that I've seen regarding the book, like, I've not read one bad thing about it. And it just seems like the only thing stopping it from being widely read is people don't know about it. And it's not as in print, but it's going to hit eventually.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we didn't touch base on like the IMDb ratings and the Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic ratings, but this has got really high ratings.
It does. I only wrote down the IMDb, but the IMDb is 7.7 out of 10. That's pretty high for IMDb. So
yeah, and Metacritic really was somewhere good. In the 80s, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it's for the people who've seen it, it's really well received.
Yeah. All right, let's give Trish your chance at casting this thing.
All right. Okay. So I'm going to start with my Eben/Evan. If we're leaving it as a guy, Eben, I put Bill Skarsgård on it because he strikes me as a guy who could get by on looks and charm. Ever since I saw Atomic Blonde, I'm like, because when you see the beginning of it, this guy's sort of skating along on like the bottom of things, but getting by simply because people kind of like him.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's an Evan, it's Stephanie Beatriz from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I just think she would be a cool looking artist. And if we're bringing it forward in time, she would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
In the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Spinney, I went rogue on this. I want to play that part. Me. If we have to cast a name as Julianne Moore, but I think that part was written for me, and I will not back down on that.
I think that's a vision of the remake first, where we've actually cast ourselves.
Yes.
Or one of us has cast ourselves.
I think
Trish has done it once before, yeah.
I have.
It might have been pre-Sam, but I'm pretty sure you have, yeah.
I really have. But yeah, no, this one I'm like, no, I was born to play that role. I believe it's me. Because I'm living that life already, except being an art dealer. That's my dream. And then, again, as we said, Gus O'Toole, Colin Farrell, that's who I put in there. Because he seems like he's a little bit older and he's just kind of cool. And I think he'd want to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
For my Matthews, I went a different way. I went with Bob Balaban.
I don't know who that is.
God, he's one of those actors. If you've seen him, you know him. He's done a lot of comedies. He's sort of a short stature man.
You can stop. You said a lot of comedies. That's why I don't know who he is.
Yeah, exactly. And then I just for Captain Cobb, because in my dream, I kind of wanted him to kind of come to Cape Cod a little earlier. And so I added that character. It's like Christoph Waltz.
Oh, nice.
And then for my Jenny, I'm struggling between these two actresses because they're both quite interesting. Like Adria Arjona, who is in Good Omens. She's very beautiful, very striking, very similar to Jenny. But then we're talking about like somebody striking. There's I've been watching Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, and it's Dreema Walker, and she's got a very interesting, striking face and like these big eyes, and she can play really young and then her actual age. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a toss up between those two. I couldn't decide, so I'm telling you about both of them. And for my director, I actually went with Velvet Buzzsaw's Dan Gilroy because I wanted it to be sort of magical, but not horror magic, but magical.
I almost went there because of his visuals in that movie, but I'd already used John Malkovich, who was in that movie. So I'm like, yeah. Nope, I'm going to have to go with somebody else. But yeah. He would guarantee that Jake Gyllenhaal would play Evan because mm-hmm. didn't he do Nightcrawler as well?
Yep.
Yes, he did.
So, yeah.
He should have been nominated.
Yes.
You know, forget should he have won. He should have been nominated. Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like Velvet Buzzsaw, watching that one, it's freaking phenomenal. Like as a horror
really
movie,
good.
It's really good. Like just as an acting thing for a movie mm-hmm. and a directing thing.
That was like really early on in our quarantine movie watching.
That was my 31 Days of Horror.
Yeah, we both did that one for our 31 Days. Cool. Well, we all had some really strong casts and mix and match. It doesn't really matter. I think we got a winner on there or another big budget bomb. I don't know.
You know what? Sometimes you just got to try. It took Planet of the Apes several tries to actually make a good. Well, I mean, to come back again. The first one did well, but the rest of them didn't.
Well, the thing is, this doesn't have to be big budget. That was the thing is, I mean, it ended up being a big budget.
No, that was, I think, Selznick.
Character didn't film.
Yeah, Selznick, who couldn't just leave well enough alone. I mean, there's no reason this movie should have cost more than Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
you could probably make it for $5 million now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you convert that initial $4 million, this is a $43 million and change by today's money. And that's a big enough budget to make this now and have a really good cast.
Yeah, for sure.
This is still pretty a small budget for even a prestige movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's about the story between Jenny and Eben. I mean, you might need one or two big scenes, but that's really it. Like,
I mean, the big set piece is the lighthouse,
which we've gotten rid of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we changed it to an airport disaster.
Oh, my. I really did miss some stuff.
Yeah. Evan doesn't make it. He has his one famous piece, but is well known because of it.
Oh, that makes sense to me. I thought that was what the whole movie was actually at the end when I watched it.
The way they punch in on the painting and he's not there and Miss Spinney is, it really does feel like he died.
Right.
But we know he didn't. In fact, early in the episode, I'm like, oh, he died. And then I remembered, oh, no, he didn't. It took me half an hour for me to remember, wait a minute, no, he didn't.
Absolutely. He should have.
Yeah. It feels like a Romeo and Juliet ending. No, you take the poison. No, you go first.
No, you go first.
I just want to see how it works.
Exactly. It's like that you hang up, but in a very dark way.
Yeah.
You hang up. No, you hang up. Die. Oh, no, you die.
Before we hang up, we want to just let you know we're in a ton of different places. We want you to share out The Invasion of the Remake, and you can do that by following us on our social media, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com. If you want to email us your suggestions, your corrections, and your fan challenges, just like Robert did for this particular episode. So if you have a movie you think is worthy of remaking, and if it fits our criteria of being challenging, something accessible, and catches our interest, then make your case and we'll consider that for a future episode.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Can I say thank you, Robert? I never would have watched this movie or heard about it unless you'd mentioned it. And it's awesome. And
I did it at the top of the show as well.
Yeah, because it really is a thank you moment or thank you film. It was really a pleasure to watch. Yeah.
I would do 10 Hard Rock Zombies to watch this.
Oh man, that's rough. That was a rough one. But it was fun. It was also fun. Some of those lower keywords. Like, that was also part of the problem, too. The better the movie is, it is much harder to actually remake, which is why we don't hit really great films. We've hit some with those notes of good.
Oh, well, this has such strong bones. It's pretty easy.
Yeah, and, you know, it's failure. The fact that none of us had heard of this movie prior to the recommendation made it a very good candidate for a remake. And just the kind of the Twilight Zone-y write-up and description of this film kind of piqued my interest.
Uh-huh.
It really wasn't the movie I was expecting, but it was damn good. And I highly recommend everybody find this. Robert told us, hey, it's on YouTube. And yeah, sure enough, there it was. So if you want to see this spectacular movie, go find it. It's free on YouTube as we speak.
And it is worth the hour and a half.
Well worth your time. And hey, if you're trapped at home, what else you got to do? You've listened to the episode. Now go watch the movie. Or do it the other way around. It's fine.
Get inspired to go for a short walk and make a social distance from, maybe it is a distance in time. Oh, and social distance.
Yeah. And hey, if you're able to meet somebody who's out of time, recommend the show via the future podcast platforms. Explain what a podcast is and then tell them that when iTunes is invented, they should subscribe to us. And that way we have a built-in audience before we ever launch. See how this works. Just tell them we're on iTunes or Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, Google Play, and even freaking YouTube.
And then
Spotify, and then they're going to go, you're just making up gobbledygook words right now. That makes no sense. these aren't words anymore.
Yes.
I'm like, yes, the future becomes really weird and bizarre. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Don't invest in these companies. Subscribe to the podcast.
Yes. No, invest in Zoom. Zoom apparently is being a mint now.
Zoom, Twitch.
Yeah, Zoom, Twitch,
YouTube. Yeah, you might make a couple of bucks.
Yeah.
Now, we'll see you again in 5 years when you're 5 years older.
Yes.
Did you write these down?
How are you doing financially?
Remember, Invasion of the Remake. They remake movies? Why would anybody do that? Hey, Dave, if you want to catch all of our previous episodes, well over 230 episodes in our library right now. Of course, they're in our back catalog. But if we do have a central web hub now, you can find them at. You can find it at our host site, libsyn.com/invasionoftheremake, or you can find it at our new Wix site. Sam, what's that address?
invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
Nice.
Perfect. So no excuses. Go find us. We are literally everywhere. And if you're just discovering us now, then go take a look at our back catalog. There'll be some movies that you'll probably not want to miss us talking about. So, All right. Well, that was Portrait of Jenny. Thanks again to Robert Mahler for putting in this request for this fan challenge. And we greatly enjoyed this film. Hey, except for Jeff, who thought it was okay.
Yeah. Well, you know what? David O. Selznick is a creep. I'll say it.
Oh, yeah. But we don't care about him. We care about the people in the movie.
Actually, so this is something we didn't touch upon. No, it's for another day.
Yeah, we're going pretty long now, so we'll save the David O. Selznick talk for another day. I'm sure we will touch
for sure.
on another one of his films.
I have words about it, too, Jeff.
Maybe we'll do that at an addendum someday. All right. Well, until that day, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
I always return as Jeff Omega sometimes.
Sometimes. who do you return as other times?
Ooh, good question. I'll have to ponder that until my next
Jenny.
Yeah.
Some days he's Jenny.
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to go. I have to go play with a man from Out of Time's heart.
Well, good luck with that. We are out of here.
Portrait of Jenny. Isn't she beautiful? I wonder if she was real.
Oh, she must have been.
What does it matter? She was real to him, or she couldn't look so alive.
How very wise you are.
Oh, heaven, is it really of me? I think someday it will hang in a museum, and people will come from all over the world to see it.